Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, August 13th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman and contributor to WAMC's The Media Project, Ira Fussfeld, executive director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead, Anna Markowitz, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
Our first story on the docket this morning, something that has been covered a lot on NPR this morning. Yesterday, the Trump administration said that it would begin a wide-ranging review of current and planned exhibitions at the Smithsonian Institution, scouring wall texts, websites, and social media to, quote, assess tone, historical framing, and alignment with American ideals, end quote. This coverage from the New York Times. Museums will be required to adjust any content that the administration finds problematic within 120 days, the letter said. Quote, replacing divisive or ideologically driven language with unifying, historically accurate, and constructive descriptions. The Smithsonian has traditionally operated as an independent institution that regards itself outside the purview of the executive branch. Initially, the White House review will focus on 8 Smithsonian museums: the National Museum of American History, the National Museum of Natural History, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the National Museum of the American Indian, the National Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the National Portrait Gallery, and the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden. Other museums will be reviewed in a later phase. The White House letter says within 30 days, the museums must provide materials, including catalogs and programs for all current exhibitions, digital files of all placards and gallery labels, and proposals for exhibitions over the next 3 years. During that time period, the administration's team will also begin observational visits and conduct walkthroughs of current exhibitions. The Smithsonian closed its diversity office shortly after the president signed an executive order banning diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at organizations that receive federal money. Last month, the artist Amy Sherald pulled her upcoming show from the National Portrait Gallery, saying the museum was concerned about her painting that depicts a transgender Statue of Liberty. Here we go. Controlling the museums. What do we think, Mark?
Well, I'm obviously not a fan, but I think we should put this in context. There's already been damage done by the Trump administration. Dr. Keith Young, who is the director of Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History, already resigned because of conflicts with the administration. So this train has already been running down the tracks for a while. Also, I don't like this. I'm against it. But I do think there's a sense of false purity behind all of the hubbub, which is the assumption that if we walk into the Smithsonian, read what's there now, or read what's on the walls of other museums that don't have Trump's fingers in them, that we'll get history as it truly was anyway. And I would challenge anybody. I mean, look, I'm a big fan of the FDR Museum. But like any piece of history, I'm in part a big fan of it because it's particularly powerful if you bring a critical eye to it. And if you look at the FDR Museum's attempt to sort of round off the edges, to put it politely, of FDR's failure with respect to civil rights in this country, you realize that history isn't portrayed in museums even where Trump hasn't gotten his fingers on them. Now, obviously, it'll get worse. So I think what, for all of us sort of thinking people who care about history and particularly care about imparting it to youth, I think this underscores the mission of teaching people how to view all of this very critically. So I don't like it, but I don't think it's a unique problem to Trump. I'd tell you can go to Hyde Park and see that if you want. And so I'm less worried about, I guess I'm more interested in the focus being on the anecdote as opposed to trying to stand in front of this particular Trump train.
I think what's particularly alarming is that he's continuing to try to take control over institutions that have historically avoided his control.
And he's using control of the executive.
Yeah. And He's using the fact that the federal government supplies 62% of the budget for the Smithsonian as a bargaining tool to take control over it. He knows that they can't survive without federal support, and he's using that to meddle when he's not wanted, just like he is with Harvard and Columbia and all of these academic institutions that he's trying to get data on. The demographics of people who are enrolling in their institutions. So I think that this is just another way that he's trying to expand his reach, and I think it's alarming. And, you know, I would love to see us do whatever we can to limit these power grabs.
Ira.
Well, I think Mark's point is well taken regarding the FDR site, except, and maybe I'm wrong about how these sites are run and who is in charge of them. If I was going to at the FDR library, where I've been a number of times, I expect to get something that's going to shape FDR as favorably as possible. My own concept of the Smithsonian Institutions is that it's a more neutral stenographic presentation of our history. And I certainly would, to the extent that I'm wrong or that it's not that exactly, I certainly would trust the people who run museums for a living to present the most likely representation of history, as opposed to somebody like Trump, who is laughably saying he wants it to be historically accurate when we know he doesn't want it to be historically accurate. So to the extent that it can be historically accurate, I certainly trust the people in charge now rather than Trump. And to your point, Anna, he seems to have a checklist going. The journalists, the academics, the medical, and now the museums, the history of inserting himself and his point of view in a way that has few, if any, other examples in our history.
Mark?
Ira, I think your point about motivation is a good one, but my point is you need to walk into any of these historical sites with a critical mind and a lens through which to view what you're being presented with. By the way, the other great historical example of historical misrepresentation is the Alamo. Again, a site that's great. It's fun to go to. I've been there many times. You learn a lot, but you got to hold the right lens up while you're there and learning about history. The other thing about all this that intrigues me is this is so small bore on the part of Donald Trump and the administration. They got a lot of other things that if they wanted to help the world, they could do. So I get this is an extension of the culture war. That's easy pickings for him and his base in terms of garnering support. It is one of these things he's doing because he can show success. He'll inevitably get to the scoreboard at some point and put a check mark next to this. I do think it's interesting, and I guess what he's after, I'm trying to think about why does he spend such an inordinate amount of time on these little things. I guess part of it is his nature, and I think part of it is he wants to maintain control, hopefully through the midterms. Clearly what's been going on in Texas emphasizes that. And I also do think that he wants to keep political control for a couple reasons, not only on a policy front, but let's not lose sight of the fact that if you roll back the tape not that long ago, this is a man who might have faced prison time if he hadn't, if what was alleged with respect to the insurrection was true and he hadn't have won the presidency. And this is a man who, at the other side of this, probably rightfully holds fear that, rightfully fears that there may be some repercussions to his conduct on the other side of these 4 years. So I don't, maybe that's the explanation, but it does intrigue me that a man who's flying off to decide, in some senses, the fate of Europe on Friday is also worrying about the placards in the Smithsonian, for gosh sake.
Well, he's looking to distract people. He's got so many things that could conceivably be dominating the cable news networks that are not favorable to him. And it's almost, you know, if I didn't dislike the guy so much, I'd almost admire the fact that he is each day is able to come up with something that is going to steal the news cycle, and something else tomorrow and something else the day after. And one of the things that we haven't heard as much of in the last 3 days is Epstein, which is right now the primary story that he's trying to get people to turn their back on. So it's part of his MO, and it's almost admirable that he does this and he's done it successfully. Because, you know, those of us, I certainly don't cover Washington, nor does my paper with its own staff. We have enough trouble covering local stuff. I forgot my point. It's just amazing how he has able to. The media knows what he's doing and still falls for it. I guess that's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah, he's trying to drown us with different stories and distract us from the fact that there are, like, large things that are happening. I mean, he's militarized D.C. and is possibly giving away parts of Ukraine in a few days. So, yeah, definitely it's like we got to keep our eyes on the prize, but at the same time, it's hard to not feel like it's a death by a thousand cuts where he's just whittling away all of the normal rules until there are no rules.
Ray writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, "This is all because Trump was listed on the impeachment wall, nothing else." That's according to Ray, a listener. Carrie writes in and says, "Is this presidential takeover of the Smithsonian part of the Project 2025 playbook? Often we say Trump did this, Trump did that, but a lot of these things he's doing have their origins in that document." And I don't know the answer to that. Is anybody in the room? So we have some homework. Check Project 2025 for dismantling of Smithsonian. Ellen writes in and says, "I think Donald Trump has too much time on his hands. If he was actually doing the job of president, he wouldn't be meddling in things that have nothing to do with his job. He seems to spend time doing nothing that matters to the country and the well-being of the American people."
Well, I think he finds that this is worth his time because it projects the power that he has, and where he sees an opportunity to get involved and create a world in his view, that's great for his ego, and it fulfills the power mission.
Two listeners write in saying we are missing the point. Mike says, "You're missing the point. This is to make sure that his view and Project 2025 can rewrite history with their own views." And we also heard from Harvey, who says the panel misses the point in the Smithsonian discussion. The First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech. This is authoritarianism.
By the way, an internet search on Google says that, yes.
You're off mic, Mark.
Oh, Project 2025, according to Google, specifically mentions the Smithsonian and proposes changes to its operations and exhibits. Wow.
So it is. Out of that playbook again, as it's hauntingly likely, it seems.
And we should check and make sure that the pandas aren't going to have to wear hats or anything.
At the zoo, the National Zoo, the pandas and the red pandas. No clothes for them.
The red pandas will have to be covered or something.
Another Mark writes in and says, "Trump's compulsion to exert control over even the tiniest small bore aspects of society and culture isn't puzzling at all. It's what aspiring totalitarians do and have always done." Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to join the conversation. We will now launch into another story. This from the Financial Times. U.S. stocks hit another record high yesterday as steady inflation figures prompted traders to increase bets that the Federal Reserve would cut interest rates next month. Wall Street's S&P 500 index gained 1.1%, and the tech-heavy NASDAQ composite climbed 1.4% to close at new peaks after the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that U.S. inflation in July held steady at 2.7%. Economists had estimated a 2.8%. The consumer price index reading came despite concerns from some economists that the aggressive tariffs U.S. President Donald Trump announced over recent months would push inflation higher. Mark Whitman. Teach us what this all means. what you think it means.
Well, I know Jerome Powell wiped his brow and gave off an audible, I don't know if it was audible, sigh of relief yesterday. Obviously, I don't know for sure. But inflation came in about where it was expected to be. There's a lot in the report, depending on what political lens you want to look through it. Housing away from home became a little bit less expensive, particularly hotel lodging. It's hilarious when you listen to the economists talk about this, as I do. Maybe I'm the only one who finds this hilarious. But if you want to be a Trump aficionado, you can say that this is because as the deportations have started, there's less demand for hotels in the United States where we're where some municipalities have been housing people who are irregular immigrants. If you don't like Donald Trump, you can say that the reason that's fallen is because less people are coming to the United States to visit, and that's why hotel prices are falling. If you last, with the last inflation report, you had to squint really hard to see the effect of tariffs. This time around, you can. And I think we've talked about on this show, at least I've suggested that the cost of tariffs will be significant. It will end up trillions of dollars over 10 years, even by Trump's own estimates. But it's not going to crush this economy. And so this gives the report that we just saw gives the Federal Reserve the clearance to cut interest rates at the next meeting, which is broadly expected. I think there's some 95% chance assigned by the market that that will take place, which will probably take some of the political pressure off of Powell and the Federal Reserve in the short run. There's a lot else going on. The gentleman that Trump nominated to head the Department Bureau of Labor Statistics, at least if you look at the European press I read, he's wildly unqualified for the position. There's a lot of concern. I think we need to wait until it's be impossible for one person alone to distort the numbers and cover it up. So we'll have to watch very carefully. But a lot of people now are on edge. And they also think that the main focus of what Trump's worried about over at the Department of Labor Statistics is not the jobs report, but is the CPI. Because it will show an increase in inflation because of tariffs. So that's just, frankly, inevitable. The other thing I would say is, you know, if your Republican friends say to you, well, what Trump's doing for the economy must be a good thing because the market is near all-time highs, there's an argument that on the other side of that, which says the following. First of all, the market's benefited from the fact that the governments in the U.S. and around the world have stood in every time there's been a crisis and sort of offered the market insurance policy, whether it be during the general financial crisis or COVID specifically. The ability of governments to continue to do that is being limited as their deficits balloon and as interest rates climb. So we should all understand that the market thinks it has an insurance policy out there, but it might not work so well this time around. And also the market's doing well because of the trend of globalization of supply chain, which has benefited Americans broadly. And Donald Trump is eroding that. And also there is, if you look at what's driven value in the stock market, there is a assumption that this AI revolution really will revolutionize our economy. Now, whether it's akin to something we've never seen before or akin to what we saw when there were railroads in this country, I don't know where it falls in between those two. But even if it's something modest as sort of the cotton gin or the railroad, it's going to represent a big change in economic potential of the world and of the United States specifically. So the fact that the tide is rising doesn't mean that Donald Trump is responsible for it. As a matter of fact, you could argue as he sells away some of the long-term attributes of this economy, including continuing to balloon our deficit, continuing to degrade the U.S. dollar and our supply chains and our standing in the world, he's sort of, as I've said before, selling the bolts off of this plane midair. We just haven't seen the consequences of that yet. So I think we all need to be really skeptical about this argument of pointing to the stock market and saying everything that Trump's doing must be a good thing. I think it's actually not the case.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, August 13th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, August 14th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute Robert Pondicio, and associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan.
About the activity in our nation's capital, the District of Columbia, otherwise known as the District. And the president announced that he was going to extend the emergency. So there was the original announcement on Monday of that the city was being riddled by crime and that the National Guard was going to be called in. Plus, the police force would now be under the control of the federal government. The president said yesterday that the emergency is far worse than he expected. And this morning we're going to focus, I believe, on D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, who at the very beginning was sort of playing the political game in the sense of honoring the wishes of the president, saying that her administration would work with his administration to do the best that they possibly could. This is even though her department and the city kept on the narrative that that actually crime had diminished in the city of in the District of Columbia. And so then, as the president continued to paint the city as a crime-addled wasteland, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser condemned and on the ground a surge in federal resources bolstering D.C. police, which she and the police chief welcome. The impact of Trump's federal actions came into view Tuesday night with National Guard troops and on the ground and agents from numerous federal agencies roaming D.C. streets from the National Mall to busy corridors in Columbia Heights. At a Wednesday evening checkpoint in Northwest Washington, local and federal officers, including immigration and customs enforcement agents, pulled over drivers for seatbelt violations and broken taillights. The crime is out of control. The White House said the overnight operation would soon become a 24/7 affair because if you're going to have a broken taillight, there's no reason you should just be pulled over at night. With a significantly greater National Guard presence, and Trump said he intended to ask Congress to extend the emergency, allowing him to federalize D.C. police beyond 30 days, we're going to be asking for extensions on that, long-term extensions, because you can't have 30 days. Trump said Wednesday, adding that his administration would be pushing a crime bill to use the city as a very positive example. Spokespeople for Bowser and Attorney General Brian Schwab declined to comment. Trump's executive action represents the most extraordinary federal intervention into the city's home rule in decades, coming as violent crime is at a 30-year low following a historic spike in 2023, according to D.C. police data. So far, top D.C. officials said the order was playing out as more of a collaborative partnership, even as they feared that Trump's repeated denigrations of the nation's capital as a dirty city, unsafe for residents and visitors, could do permanent damage to its image on the national stage. Because one of the letters that I got yesterday from Teresa was on the subject, I would like to begin with her.
I context here, I lived in D.C. in the 80s and 90s. I think you lived in D.C. also?
Did
you? No.
I work there now. My office is at the American Enterprise Institute, is just off DuPont Circle. I don't live there, obviously. I live up here, but I'm a frequent visitor 10, 12 times a year.
Right. So I think that there's some context is really important here, both about what's going on with the Trump administration, what is the context in which they decide to do this, which is fairly unlawful, and then what's been going on with the Trump administration and D.C. itself before this. I think you have to remember, to me, this is a very, very, very expensive distraction and an unlawful one. But you have to remember that ICE, you know, the ICE detentions, they continue, and there was a lot of, you know, public was turning on him because of the type of detention. He claimed that they were going to go after the worst of the worst, but story after story shows that it's, you know, picking up lawful citizens, picking up people with, you know, they were trying to, anyway, there's, detentions are expensive, wasn't going well, needed to get that off the front pages. There's what's going on in Gaza. Just by the way, yesterday, 25 more people were killed by the Israelis as they were trying to access food. More than 100 children dying of starvation recently. You know, that, and they're just blockading the access to food. And there was media attention on that, that they needed to shift from the tariffs, you know, 90 deals in 90 days, not happening. People are feeling the impact of the tariffs in every direction. You know, people understanding the budget bill that was passed is not going to be in their favor. But most importantly is the Epstein situation, where they could not control that message. And I think that they were looking to shift the message. And as so I heard a commentator say last night, and I believe that, you know, his standard go-to when he's in trouble is, you know, anger, race, crime, you know, everything's being unrun and I alone can fix it. But the troubles in D.C., you know, think about what his administration's policies have done to D.C. recently. I mean, they've been reeling from the impacts of COVID, right? And the people not working in the city anymore. But just in the last couple of months, all of these firings of employees, many of them are residents of D.C. who've lost their job, or a lot more people now coming into D.C. to work because they have been fired. Over $1 billion in funding that's been frozen that was scheduled to go to them, and a whole range of federal cuts. And including most recently a 40% cut in security funding. That's law enforcement, community policing programs and such. And so there's been this Trump administration economic assault on the city. And into that context, he decides to, after what he did in Los Angeles, decide that crime is at an all-time high. Not true. Those statistics are wrong. In fact, they have been reducing crime. It spiked in 2023, but it's gone down. So what does he do? They claim that the numbers are not true, that the crime statistics are not true. Well, you know, that's rich for somebody like him, given what he did with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where he didn't like the numbers, so he fired the person who gave them. But in any case, I think that this is a distraction from the key issues. It's an attempt to shift blame because of the impact of his policies. And it's just a very dangerous takeover. And if you think back, what's the most violent day in Washington since the 60s, right? That's the insurrection. That's an insurrection that he provoked, where over 140 law enforcement officials were brutally beaten while he sat in the White House and did nothing. Right? You want to talk about violent crime out of control. Go back and look at the tapes of what happened on January 6th. And not only did he do that, but then the Justice Department went and legally, lawfully investigated and prosecuted those people. And what did he do when he first came in? He pardoned them, put them back out on the streets. And then not only did he pardon them, but he went out and methodically fired those people within the Justice Department who did those lawful prosecutions. So, you know, and the other thing that I'm going on too long, but the other thing that stuns me is I've been watching, we're supposed to have the 26 appropriations bills passed by October 1st. That's the new fiscal year. Look at what's in those appropriations bills for law enforcement. Deep cuts in violence prevention programs, deep cuts in community policing, deep cuts in the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms around all issues relating to the control of gun violence, right? So in this context of, you know, they are going to be the ones that come in and solve the crime problem, in Washington, D.C.? Really? Really? And they're going to come in and sweep up homeless people and move them to where? Right? Really? I'm ranting.
No, you're not ranting. I do want to get back to, I want to hear from everyone, and we'll do that. I do want to get back to, well, I was going to say, I really want to get back to the homeless issue, because I think that's paramount here as a real problem.
Yes.
With what's being done. So I would like to mention on that, and we can certainly talk about the mayor as well. J.P. Miller.
That was excellent, Teresa. I think it is a... it is a unique time right now that we're in that last week it was announced that New York City has the fewest shootings in the first 6 months of this year ever since they started collecting the statistics, which I believe was 1994. So the fewest number of shootings ever. And that news, the way the media operates, of which we're all kind of part, we're on the radio here, it just, that news doesn't get out there.
Right.
If it was the highest number of shootings mm-hmm. in a year, it would be on the front page of every newspaper every single day that you could. But also yesterday, the NYPD said overall crime in New York City is down to its lowest level in 25 years. So these are remarkable statistics that you see coming out. And so there is this divide as to what the police are reporting and what the president is,
fabricating,
is promulgating, and there are also, in addition to that, there's also a stark partisan divide, mm-hmm. where Republicans, if you poll Republicans, they say crime is out of control, and if you poll Democrats, they say crime is at a manageable level. And so this is, as you say, Teresa, an effective tool for Trump to get his base motivated.
Bring them back home.
And helps him politically.
And also, in a common sense world, and... yeah, we've got that. In a common sense world, if a city was having problems and their numbers were up, let's say, slightly... that they would work with the federal government for assistance as opposed to and being overtaken.
I want to hear from other people, but I would, because I worked on in Boston, ran the Safe Neighborhoods program to try to contain violence, and I'd love to, but I don't know.
Okay. Catherine.
I agree with you, Teresa. This is mostly political theater. It's a distraction from bigger issues. And bringing in more law enforcement, the National Guard, like, it's not going to actually help reduce crime, right? Crime is symptomatic of deeper structural issues. And I think with this case, it highlights two major problems. As Joe noted, homelessness, and the other is juvenile crime. Those two things seem to be what they're fixated on. And with homelessness, as Teresa brought up, ship them out to where? How are we? What does it mean to get rid of homelessness in D.C.? And it's a large population. And, you know, what Trump has done already has not helped the homeless population. He has cut funding for addiction research and treatment grants. He has reduced Medicaid. And these are things that people rely on, vulnerable populations rely on.
If I may just interrupt for one moment, I mean, one other thing about this too, mm-hmm. and I just want to keep this on the front burner, which is this mashing together of violent crime and the homeless.
That's
Thank
right.
You.
As if to say the homeless is responsible for that violent crime.
Yeah, absolutely. It's conflating the two issues, and that's not what, you know,
and
data is supporting. Yeah,
a little factoid. On homelessness, I was reading, and then I heard it reported yesterday. Zero beds available mm-hmm. for homeless people right now because there's such a backlog. Mm-hmm. Zero beds in D.C. available. Anyway.
Well, I think what they're going to do is just sweep people up and put them in prison, all these private prisons, right? Because where else are they going to go? You can't just make people disappear. Well, I mean, these days
you
the government
make
is making
disappear.
they are
were
making
working
people
on that
disappear.
Last night.
You know, and why not invest in programs that get at the root of the issue as opposed to like spending what we're about to spend over $40 billion on detention centers, right? So
private
why not,
prisons.
Mm-hmm, why not address the root of the issue, addiction, housing, helping people get employment? And the other issue that that's been highlighted is juvenile crime. Similar thing. Why not get to the root of the issue and help these children, right? Yeah. They, Piro was saying that, you know, they are treated too soft in the justice system. They're given ice cream socials and yoga, which is not what's going on at all. If anything, there's a lot of violence and overcrowding in these detention centers. Also, there's understaffing. There's been reported sexual abuse and physical abuse. So these are not comfortable places. These children are not being coddled in any way.
I have to say, if I were in one of these places and I had to do yoga, that would be cruel and unusual punishment. I have to.
Oh man, I could use some yoga right now.
No, I know. I guess I'm not. I'm not dissing anyone who benefits from yoga. I'm just not one of those people. Robert,
so many thoughts. Okay, let's allow that it's a distraction. Well, we're being distracted by it, then, aren't we? In this very conversation. So, you know, why?
Well, it's a real thing that's happening.
Well, this is exactly my point, Joe. So, I mean, as somebody who does spend a lot of time in Washington, do I feel unsafe there? Not really. Well, I will say this. When I go to D.C., there's a late Amtrak train that if I miss it, I'm stuck in Union Station overnight. And that's happened to me once or twice. And let's just say that there is a palpable sense of menace that accompanies that. That is, I would not recommend.
I agree with you fully, but would that be the case if you were at Union Station in Philadelphia or Penn Station in New York City?
Depends on the time of day, obviously.
Right, but I'm saying at night. I mean,
sure.
I think that's a common thing.
Of course, of course.
Or
of course.
A Republican-run city in a Republican state like
during the day, DuPont Circle, which is a block away from my office, I used to look forward to walking through DuPont Circle on my way to or from my office, and I don't anymore. It's basically a homeless encampment. It feels unsafe to walk through it. But look, the larger point I want to make is that it's one thing to talk about, what is the data point we keep hearing, that crime is at a 30-year low, that it's down 35% or both. I think for most Americans, this is not a data-driven phenomenon. It's about the sense of ease, unease, menace, call it what you will, that you feel in your day-to-day life. You don't have to have been a crime victim to feel guarded when you walk around our major cities, and D.C. is not an exception to this. So I mean, think for a moment about if you want to promote this narrative that, hey, Trump is distracting you from other problems. Well, there you go again. In other words, he is forcing the Democrats into defending the status quo, saying crime isn't so bad when many voters see that as unacceptable. The CVS on DuPont Circle, when I'm down there, literally everything is behind glass. So now you want to be the political party that says, hey, things aren't so bad when people who live in the city have to ask an attendant for a tube of toothpaste. Now, if that's the narrative you want to go with it. But I'm just saying you got to recognize the disconnect between people's daily experience and being told, well, the data says X. Well, people don't necessarily care what the data says. They care about how they feel.
That was Robert Pondicio on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, August 14th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Friday, August 15th, Joe was joined by EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan.
All right, let's get started with what is going on in the news, and quite a bit, as you may have noticed. And we begin with the big story of the day, and that, of course, is the meeting taking place between the President of the United States and the President of Russia, Donald Trump, and what's his name?
Oh,
Vladimir Putin. Thank you very much.
Putin.
And so we want to hear from you on this and want to hear from our group on what is going on. This is going to be, this meeting, of course, takes place in Alaska and is something that has been, well, not in the works for a very long time, but has turned around very quickly. So there's an article in the New York Times this morning, how President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin could unfold. A sudden feud, an impasse, or a first step toward a ceasefire in Ukraine are all possible at the summit as the two leaders navigate thorny issues. This is issues such as Ukraine's territory and NATO expansion. These each of these could manifest in Anchorage when President Trump and Vladimir Putin meet at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, the first face-to-face discussion between American and Russian leaders since the invasion of Ukraine 3.5 years ago. And the scenarios that could unfurl are as unpredictable as the leaders themselves, both brimming with confidence that in a personal encounter they can manipulate events and each other. Sounds like a charming afternoon, doesn't it? So we'll find out more as the day progresses, but as we preview this conversation and talk about what is possible and what is important, we go to our panelists. Judith, would you like to start us off?
Well, wouldn't it be nice if they got a ceasefire? So I think we all have to root for that, but also be realistic about what's really unfolding here. You know, the funny thing about Trump is 1 week he is in a bromance with Putin. The next week he's telling him, if you don't knock it off with more bombing in Ukraine, you know, I'm really not going to be your friend. You know, 1 week he is so harsh towards Zelensky. We all remember the fated White House meeting that was so awful. You know, and then Zelensky gets on the phone with him and they're best buddies. And so, you know, Trump has been very inconsistent on Russia and Ukraine. I think Putin will probably gain more out of this than the United States for two reasons. One is it gives Putin some diplomatic legitimacy, which I don't think he deserves. He's been pretty isolated, particularly with European leaders. I think the big mistake is not having Zelensky at the table. Trump is saying, well, we're going to do a second meeting and maybe invite Zelensky and other EU leaders. I was struck by the fact that Putin is bringing a delegation of businesses with him. And there was some reporting that they may talk about extracting mineral rights in Alaska for Russia. So I think there is there's a pretty strong business element to this. I hope they're serious about working on a ceasefire. And remember, you know, Putin thought he would just roll over Ukraine. He thought this war would be over in a week or two, and Ukraine is hanging on. American attention has shifted more to Gaza because of the destruction and the starvation there. But I think this meeting reminds us that Putin wants to grab as much territory in Europe as he can. And so, you know, I hope they have a productive meeting, but my expectations are very low.
What we know about the meeting schedule, according to the White House, the summit is expected to begin in Alaska around 3 o'clock our time, and that Trump and Putin will say a few words before holding a one-on-one conversation with interpreters present. Negotiations will then continue over a working breakfast, which will include Russian and U.S. delegations, with 5 representatives each accompanied by experts. Also, aides are saying that the Russian members were, that they have a whole list of Russian aides and business leaders, as you mentioned, people who will be in that room. The team traveling with Trump include Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. That, according to the White House, and the White House Press Secretary confirmed the one-on-one talks would be followed by a bilateral lunch. Oh, those are good.
Well, I have the answer from the Magic 8-Ball, if anyone wants to know.
Yeah, what does it say?
So I first asked, will the Trump-Putin meeting in Alaska today result in a ceasefire? And it said, yes, why not? I'm like, this is not.
That's not an answer. This is, right.
And so then I changed it to the Putin-Trump meeting, and it said, yes, but it will take time. I think that might be... That might be
but
accurate.
Those are not Magic 8-Ball answers.
No, I know. So it's not the original. No, the other ones were, you know, signs point to.
All signs point to, yes.
Right, yeah.
Try again
definitely
later.
Maybe. Yeah, something right. like that, right?
But,
so what do you think rather than the
so
Magic 8-Ball?
So here's what I think. I think it's very interesting. First off, I don't think it's a problem that he doesn't have Zelensky there because I think that is a putting them in the same room without having some preset notion as to where it might go is probably not positive. It's probably not going to be helpful. These guys hate each other. And I think that probably it's not a bad idea. I do think that part of this, the timing may be a distraction from the whole Epstein thing. Mm-hmm. But I also think that, you know, given who's going to be there, it does look like Trump's approach is to look for a financial incentive to get Putin to figure out a way to claim victory and not be a further threat. I don't trust Putin for 10 seconds, but it's an interesting approach, right? And that's why he's got these business people there, and possibly that's why it's in Alaska. It's also, you know, not a long flight for Putin, although
no.
He goes back in time, actually.
Please go on.
Yeah, I think the last thing I really wanted to say is I think the administration has very intentionally been setting the expectations low on this. I don't think they believe they're going to get a ceasefire out of this meeting. But if they can get the beginnings of some kind of maybe trade discussion that would be linked to Russia, you know, having the ability to, A, declare a victory and, B, stop. That's what it looks to me like their end game is. And also, I would say, you know, the reverse of that is if it goes nowhere, this gives the administration the cover to basically impose additional sanctions. And they could do that now, but it looks like an escalation. It looks like a provocation, and it certainly would be portrayed that way by Putin if they didn't have maybe the kabuki theater of having a real discussion and having it fall apart. So, you know, for all of that, he doesn't need Zelensky there, and having Zelensky there would probably be a distraction because the goal is not to have Zelensky and Putin reach an agreement with each other, which will happen like on Never Day. So,
you know, I don't disagree with you on that, although I do. It does seem counterintuitive when you're talking about two leaders talking about a country that isn't yours in
yep.
the sense in the
mm-hmm.
sense of
yep.
that you think what are we talking about? We're talking about Russia. We're talking about Ukraine, and you would think that the head of Ukraine would be in the room.
Yeah. So yeah, Putin has tried to frame this whole conflict as Russia, not Russia against Ukraine, but Russia against the U.S. and Russia against the West generally, and this totally feeds into that.
Yeah.
If But, you know, the stakes are so incredibly high. You right now, Russia, like the tide has once again shifted. Russia's solidly in occupying a bunch of what used to be Ukrainian territory. You'd hate, like, as Judith said, you'd like to think there's a ceasefire coming, but I'm not sure a ceasefire that just freezes in place the status quo is going to satisfy Ukraine.
And a ceasefire negotiated with Zelensky at the table is a loss for Putin. And I think that it's a capitulation, right? So I think because then Zelensky gets credit for it, and he can't have Zelensky get credit for it. He needs for it to be a victory that he got for the Russian people. By he, I mean Putin. So I'm not surprised. And now I am far from a, you know, diplomatic expert, but you don't putting someone at the table who has no ability to move the ball forward because he can't give up more. And that's what Putin wants, right? It's not useful.
Yeah. Putin just wants, I think he wants a couple things, but most notably, as you say, Heather, he wants more territory. I actually think Putin will play Trump because he knows the way you play Trump is you flatter him. Not hard to do if you can just kind of suck it up and do it. Putin's economy is collapsed. You know, yeah. He's in terrible shape. When Joe read the names of the U.S. delegation, the Treasury Secretary, the Commerce Secretary, I think that points to they're really looking at business deals,
yes,
and lesser tariffs. And I would argue... Why do we want a business relationship with Putin, who kills his political adversaries, who is so far from a democracy? Why do we want that relationship?
Yeah, it's sort of a question of how much we're willing to concede to him and how much we're willing to let him save face in order to stop the bloodshed. Yeah. And like that is, I mean, it's a pretty cynical calculation, but that's what diplomacy ends up being.
Pay your way out of it.
I mean, there's not a whole lot of paths here, right? One is escalate and get directly involved. Another, and he's not going to do a ceasefire if we threaten that, right? So the other is, you know, have Ukraine cede more land, which is not acceptable because that's just going to encourage Putin to continue on and start looking at Poland and Finland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and certainly I think the folks over there are very worried about that possibility. And then the last is figure out some other avenue, some door that Putin can gracefully exit through with the belief that he would stay out that door. And, you know, I don't think he's going to stay out that door. But he's human and he's not going to be around forever either. And the Russian people at some point have to realize that this was not something that was beneficial to them in any way.
Yeah. Just a few hours ago, Trump did a gaggle on Air Force One and about the trip on his way to Alaska. And a reporter asked him, would you ever consider putting American security forces on the ground in Ukraine? Mm-hmm. And he said, maybe, but not through NATO. And then he dissed NATO. And he said, maybe with European partners. So, yikes.
That would be such a turnaround for Trump. Like, Trump has wanted to avoid foreign entanglements, at least rhetorically.
Yeah, but that...
And in fact, he has avoided.
That's got to be directed at Putin, right? Like, this is one of the... I just ran through those possibilities. That's one of them. And Putin, if his... You know, we don't really know if he's feeling like his back is against the wall. But if he is, you know, giving him some kind of trade agreement, lifting of sanctions or whatever, with no new land. I mean, that... I think that seems to be what I think the agenda is. And if it's not, probably should be, right? Like, because there's no other options here.
Mm-hmm. So, it's kind of a negotiating tactic is to appear crazy. And we have two people who are crazy in their own ways, right? Trump is mercurial and willing to blow things up, turn on a dime. And Putin is crazy in the more kind of, you know, violent and bloodthirsty way. It's really like the possibilities here are kind of horrible to think about.
Well,
but I'm also struck by the historical echoes. Like, you know, the U.S. bought Alaska from Russia in 1867.
Maybe it's
and part of the
back.
Reason the Tsar at the time wanted to sell was that he needed money after a war in Crimea, so which is, you know, Putin recently annexed away
from. So what else does Alaska have that we could buy?
Oh, they want the minerals.
Well, right, but minerals. Trump loves the idea of adding new territory to the U.S. Like, is there something that, I mean, maybe that's an interesting thought. Like, can't buy Greenland from them, right, or Iceland from them, but is
there some
Canada?
Island. Wasn't there some island
that
recently changed hands or something?
I don't know. Maybe there's something up there that he wants to buy.
Well, this is a moment where it's really too bad the U.S. State Department has been hollowed out because, you know, the way these things work is a lot of advanced meetings with skilled diplomats who know how to do this. But Trump has created this climate where he and only he can cut the deal. And I'm pretty pessimistic that, you know, it's going to work. I don't think there was any advanced bilateral discussions.
Bill, a moment ago, was talking about the difference between the two men and how they'll look at this. This is how Roman put it, which is, so the devil and the Antichrist are meeting to decide how to carve up Ukraine. Great. And that kind of
feels like a South Park episode.
Puts it in a nutshell.
Yeah, talk about bad vibes in that room. Ooh, Trump and Putin together. Ooh.
Adam says, I have zero confidence that anything productive will get done. Janice says, I find it such a sad reflection of our current state of affairs that such an important meeting is happening between two amoral men who don't care anything about anyone but themselves. Scary as heck, says Janice.
So I'm not going to remember all the history on this, but Ronald Reagan made a big deal about creating a missile defense shield, which all the technocrats thought was a disastrously bad idea that would lead to escalation and et cetera. But he wanted to do it, and he convinced the Russians at the time that he was going to do it, that he was crazy enough that he was going to do that. And for that reason, they started making a bunch of concessions at the bargaining table on nuclear weapons. So I remember at the time being horrified at what Reagan was doing, and yet it turned out to pay off in the end. So, we can cross our fingers.
That was Bill Hammond on the Roundtable panel on Friday, August 15th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.